Welcome. And with humility and great appreciation, I occupy this seat with your permission. I considered it a beautiful honor, a wonderful honor that you allow me this. We just sat 40 minutes of Zendo and of Zen, Zazen, walked Kinhin, and maybe, if it's possible, I could, or would like to even bring us closer into this community by reciting the words of one of my favorite poets with an invitation. Out beyond ideas of right doing and wrong doing, there is a field. I'll meet you there. When the soul lies down in that grass, the world is too big to talk about. Too full. Even the phrase each other doesn't mean anything. So I hope we're meeting together in that field. And I'm thinking, here in this place, this is our field. And I'm thinking of Dogen saying, the heart of Zen is intimacy. And not knowing is most intimate. So, I'm given the job of giving a way-seeking talk tonight. I've done that before, done it twice before at Tassajara. I've heard many. And without being rude or having it sound like sacrilege, I've come to see it or feel it as a strange practice, because a story about one's life or how they came to be here in this field, in this Zendo, with this incredible group of people. It's impossible to tell that story. It's all lies. It's a story of lies. If I tell the story of my life, and I know that's not what this talk is supposed to be about, I should and I will in some way give some at least seminal points and some background to how I think, my misty memory and totally fallible recollection, how I might have stumbled my way here. I think I owe that. It's about story. It's about stories that are never true. And I choose to tell this by way of calling it as the dual story. We've talked so much about the relative and the absolute. Two stories. One story. Beginningless time. No time. Beginningless. Well, I think that deserves a moment's consideration. Infinity. Creating the possibility for all of us, me, you, to have, as part of this mysterious Tao, been around forever, one form or another. And so my story could be, I've been Buddha, just like you, an infinite number of times. And I don't care how silly that sounds, because if you consider beginningless, endless infinity, well then everything is possible, you could say inevitable. Dalai Lama likes to talk how we've all been each other's mother, and we've all been each other's murderer, and we've all been insects, and we've all been everything under the sun. Countless times. So remember, this is part of a story. So how could I tell that story? Because in that context, how I got here is the most absurd and crazy mystery I could imagine. But it makes this nonsense. And that's okay. In some unimaginable way, coming from, I have no idea where, I dropped into this lifetime, this world. That story is one that begins with a period of time I don't remember, but I do remember, interestingly, a period of time maybe when I was a youngster, 10 years old or whatever, laying in bed and having it occur to me, and maybe it's because I went through the loss of a younger brother when I was young. He died 3 years younger than me of leukemia. And that affected our family in a great way, as it does all families. Maybe that affected me in some way in terms of my understanding or awareness of death. I don't know. Or maybe it was just me. But I would lay there and try to contemplate things without end. And if they did have an end, what would be outside that end? And that was impossible. And I didn't like thinking about this, and I didn't appreciate being presented with that kind of situation which I was supposed to live in. I mean, it didn't make any sense out of at all. And I would stay awake many nights puzzling that and being really frustrated and irritated by, well, what is this? I don't understand this. And I don't know, it seems, I don't, when I talk to other people, most of them say, well, when I was 10, I wasn't thinking of that. But it was bad enough that my parents actually sent me to a psychiatrist because they thought there's something bothering me and wrong with me. And along with that, the idea that I would be doing all this if I accepted to join this preposterous play, it seemed to me, then also at the end I was going to die. And that even made less sense. So why was I bothering with this? And I went to the psychiatrist, and it was a woman, and she tried to explain, well, you know, Richard, there are many beautiful things in this life. It's an amazing journey. It's a rare one. It's a great honor. I'm sure you'll find plenty of reasons to be very happy to be alive. And I said, I don't think so. And she basically told my parents, I can't help your son. He seems to be pretty stuck on that idea. And that may be the beginning of a path. What happened after that, I don't even really remember. I know a few years passed. Next thing I knew, I was interested in sports and maybe a little bit with girls and with being strong and weightlifting and good at the sports and just being a guy. But another thing I have to say, and I have a picture back there of two Indians, really one, fighting themselves. The model I grew up with, watching the TV of what a man should be, was a rugged individual cowboy gunslinger who didn't start things, but he sure could finish them. And the girls all loved them. And strangely, and then they were just right off. Possibly ambiguously gay. Who knew? Why is he doing this? But that was the model. And along with that model, I also had been given the idea that somehow, musically at least, I was a prodigy. And I was supposed to follow that up. And so I was immediately given lessons and every opportunity, the best teachers. But I found myself living a life like those two Indians inside the one, of having that model that I saw of the cowboys in me, of wanting to be heroic and macho and masculine and undefeatable and admired by the women and the girls, and riding off into the sunset, and circumstances, causes and conditions also set me up with the idea that I was a complete liar and a faker, a bluffer, that I could never do any of these things or live up. The responsibility was too great for me. So that's the background, really, if I'm going to be candid about my life, of what I've lived with in hopefully lessening degrees, but always to this day. That struggle of two in the one. And I remember, if I were to talk about influences that I remember. And I remember in high school, my greatest influence was Jack London. Boy, he fit the bill. called the wild up in the Yukon, being a man facing the elements and being out in nature, facing death, in the end dying, and his great friend and part wolf or part collie went back to live in the wild. And White Fang, and it turned out that he in real life was very much the character I wanted to be. He was a socialist, as my family was, and I was brought up. He was a civil rights activist. This is back in the early turn of the century. He was a labor rights activist, a unionist, and a great adventurer. He went to the Yukon, got sick, failed, but had all kinds of adventures. And so he was, I think, really the first literary experience I had in terms of reading and being moved and an interest in nature, an interest in transformation. And the 60s came around pretty quick, but even before that, there was the late 50s where I was listening to jazz every night on the radio, Symphony Sid, WEVD, which stood for WEVD Boys. We were on the end of the dial. I would listen every night, even from when I was 9th or 10th grade. I'd listen to him, and I'd listen to Shepard. I forget his first name. Gene Shepard. He would tell stories. Those also were my influences growing up, and I was at that time constantly going to New York and taking jazz lessons, and those ended, I think, when I was in 11th grade with my teacher saying, Richard, I can't teach you anymore because you won't learn. You have the most talent of any student I have, but you have the least ability to develop it of anybody I have. And I would say go find out what's stopping you and then come back if you ever find that out. So that was happening. But in the late 50s, we were listening and we were being affected by Ginsberg and Ferlinghetti, and I knew I'd forget his name, the English fellow that would talk to us about Zen. Who was that? Alan Watts, of course. And I and my friends enjoyed listening to him and what he had to say. It was interesting. We weren't becoming monks, but it all made sense. It was good. Those were seminal influences in my early years, still in high school. Then things just, gaps occurred. I did the obligatory going off to school, but I went as far away as I could just to get away from everything and everybody, and spent the first couple of years just not doing anything seriously, and skiing out in Denver and playing pool and wasting my time. And I told my parents, I don't want to do this anymore, and I want to do something else that I think is worthwhile. I had read Exodus, and it seemed to me and my Jewish friends, the ones I grew up with, that we weren't very interested in being Jewish. Maybe we were even a little ashamed of it. And when I read Exodus, I decided, I think it's time for me to be Jewish and proud. We were never religious. My parents called themselves atheists. I thought that was a little odd. I thought agnosticism was good enough, you know, but that's what they call themselves. I won't get into them now. They're amazing people, and I have some pictures back there at tea or whatever. Anyone's welcome to look. That's for another time. My parents, amazing, interesting. But they said, no, one more year, and you must, or we'll disown you. You can't go do anything else. And so I said, okay, and then I did that year, and I behaved the same way. I couldn't care about it less. It didn't mean anything to me. I didn't know why I was doing it. I got back home, and I worked in a factory for a year, made enough money to get myself to Israel, because I was going to be Jewish and proud. And I lived there for a year on a kibbutz, and it was a great experience. Traveled around Europe and decided when I was going to come home, I was going to, like my father, who was a dentist, but really his life consisted of being an environmentalist. That's what he really, really devoted his life to. Made a living being a dentist, but I wish I had a clock here, but how much more time do I have?
13 minutes.
To talk. I want to tell one thank you. I want to tell one that I think was probably the most important one maybe in my entire life. That happened on one of Dad's and my fishing trips, which happened almost every weekend once trout season opened. Most of the time we would go to the Catskills. The night before, there still were night crawlers, which there aren't anymore through reasons of toxicity and poisoning and whatnot. But back in those days, we'd go out on our lawn and it would be moist with dew. And they would, in the night, be coming up out of their holes and be getting in the evening air, I guess, or whatever. And we could take flashlights and flashlight on them, and they would freeze. And we'd grab them and get our bait. So if we wanted to use worms, we could. But we also tied flies to match the flies that would be hatching at those particular times of year, so we could bait fish or we could fly fish. And we would get up at sometimes midnight after having gotten those worms and start our trip up to the Catskills. A couple hour trip, we'd be listening to gospel music if it was Sunday, and I remember one time, and I don't remember, but 12, 13 years old. Had my waders on. We got to the stream. Sun just started rising. Cool, coldish spring morning. Smell of fresh water and trout. You could smell when trout are in the water. There's a certain kind of smell. You could smell it at Tassajara Creek. There's a freshness and a certain delicious fish smell. And I was in the water and the sun was rising and I was casting my bait trying to catch a trout. And I remember that. I saw the sun just coming over the mountain. I was in the water, in the stream with my waders. I was trying, like people and other animals would and other humans for countless years, to catch something to eat. And it occurred to me in that undescribable way that I was a part of this whole scene. It was all natural. And it was just as natural for me to be right in the middle of it doing exactly what I was doing. And we were all in that together. Everything, the sun rising, the fish swimming, the water flowing, the trees swaying. Me doing what this animal does. That's something you don't forget. I never forgot. That was a feeling of oneness that we talk about all the time. We talk about how to get it. What do we do to recover that sense of being alive and being one with things, each in our own way, doing our own thing? What a gift that was. To me, that was it. That was the first real awareness I had. And moving ahead, when I came back from Israel, and I decided, that's what I want to do. I want to work. I want to be an environmentalist. And I want to work with the environment, and with fish, and with ecology. And that's what I'm going to do. And I was serious about that. I got into Cornell. And for the first year or so, that was my intention. I was focused. And I had taken off now, so now I'm a little older, and now it's starting to become the middle of the 60s, and something is happening. And it's the Vietnam War. And the Vietnam War became not to my liking, something I couldn't avoid, even though for a little while I ignored it. But Cornell was really like the Eastern Berkeley. It was the hotbed of anti-war activity. And I got swept up in it fully. And it really led to a complete shift in the course of my life, away from academics, away from a belief that I could really be a useful part of a meaningful system that made sense and that I could help in. It turned from that to one of anger and cynicism. It took me over. And for the next couple of years, even though I faked my way through my schoolwork, I was consumed by the war, and our leader there was a great Jesuit. Priest Daniel Berrigan and his brother Philip, that whole group of Jesuits were like just amazing heroes, and he was our hero, and he was leading us to do things like go to Central Park and burn our draft cards. Right, with the FBI guys right among us, all dressed in their suits, and we knew who they were. We still said, we're burning. We knew guys who would be going to jail for that. My dad said, if you do that, I'll disown you. And I said, well, come on, Dad, you know better than that. Stand up. Be with me. I did it, and he didn't disown me. That was a turning point. That even though when I graduated Cornell and took a respite to go out and be, as I had always done every summer, every year, I had always gone off for an adventure of some kind, to be a lumberjack in Canada. You know, I'm still trying to be Jack London. You know. Or I would go be a roughneck in an oil field. And this, I heard about these oil fields in Montana. They were making good money, and it was easy work, easy job, not easy work, easy to get a job. And I went out there and got a job working as a roughneck in an oil field. And I did that for 6, 7, 8 months, and then I found out I got accepted with an assistantship in graduate school to go to University of Rhode Island School of Oceanography. And I thought, well, they're going to pay my way. And I will be learning something I want to learn. But I've been ignoring the war, too. I've been just sort of burnt out on that. And I don't know how I'm going to make the two work. And I decided to go. And I went, and I really will try and cut this short now. I went, and almost immediately I find myself drawn back into the anti-war movement, and now stronger than ever because I'm older and not on the graduate campus. Nobody doing a thing, no matter what I said, no matter how I pleaded, not one student, not one teacher would agree to taking one day off to say no business as usual. So I went to the main campus at Kingston, and I became one of the leaders of the anti-war movement at that school. And we held teach-ins. I had all the seven, Chicago Seven, them and Noam Chomsky. I had every kind of, and it was mainly me. I would get these people, and then I'd have them stay at my house, and then they would give a talk, a big teach-in. Thousands of kids would come. And we were doing meaningful things, and we were doing sit-ins and getting our heads cracked in by Rhode Island State Police. And there just came a point where, again, I just felt like this school business is a lie. I can't do this anymore. And I went to Washington with Rennie Davis, and we spent 6, 7, 8 months doing all kinds of demonstrations and mock grand juries with people testifying and one thing and another. And after about 6 months, I broke down. I broke down because I felt like nothing we do is going to stop this. We could stand on our heads, we could give our lives, and this thing is just going to, they do what they want. And what I, in my time, working as an activist, was exposing to me the darkest, worst, most unimaginable things that normal people, and I would even venture to say the majority of people, even in this room, don't know how atrocious the things we were doing were and had been doing, it turns out, before and have done after. But we would go around and show movies from the Newsreel Collective to other colleges where soldiers had taken pictures of what they were doing, Marines. And then this Newsreel Collective got a hold of just hundreds, maybe thousands of them. And it would show things I wouldn't, out of my love and my care for you folks, I wouldn't speak up now, that were beyond speaking. But we thought it was important that people at least were exposed to this to get a sense of. And when I finally broke down at working in Washington, there was nothing left. I felt like I couldn't do any more. I was useless. And I went home, back to my home in Croton. And that's where my next phase, and I'll end with this, basically. That's where my next phase began, because I felt like I needed something, a new start. I needed some new hope. It was gone. I was emptied. I was totally lost and cynical. And I started reading, I think the first book probably that I read was Autobiography of a Yoga. Yogi, remember? Yogananda. And that got me stirring. And then probably the next series of books I read were the Castaneda books, and they got me stirring. They got me even more stirring, much more stirring in Black Elk, and then more about shamanism and everything I could get my hands on then about the Medicine Way, the Red Road, the Way of the Shaman. Started doing journeys, vision quests, and also was reading Idris Shah about Sufism, and then read Suzuki Roshi's Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. And that was about the time where all my friends were moving to California, and I decided, of course, well, that's the place to be. We'll all go there. Maybe we'll start a community. But the first thing I want to do is I want to go see Suzuki Roshi. I didn't know he had already died. So in 1975, I came out, got to Carmel, and I actually found that southern entrance, and it was closed for the winter, so I was disappointed I couldn't go. So I went on and went to live in West Marin among my friends, musician friends, and started doing music and carpentry and just making a living, living in my truck for about a year. Had a piano in it, so I always had my piano with me. Yeah, and I was never without my piano. And there, the first thing I really started getting interested in was going to Sufi camps. And those Sufi camps were led by Pir Velayat, the son of Hazrat Inayat Khan, who had brought Sufism, basically, had brought Sufism to America. And each time I could, and it was usually once or twice a year, I would go to two-week camps. And we would meditate. We wouldn't talk about Sufi theory particularly. We would meditate. We would dance. We would sing. Pir Velayat would talk us sometimes through a meditation, the different planes he was reaching, and he'd say, stay with me, and then if you can't, at some point, just drop off and stay there. And we'd do that most of the day. And also, for those 2 weeks, I wouldn't talk. And then I would notice at the end of those 2 weeks, something really would change in me. Not talking, not leaking. All that energy for those 2 weeks had shifted something. Things were brighter, things were clearer, things were more beautiful, things were didn't need to be talked about so much. And then to end that little story part of my life, at some point, friends of mine that I was doing construction with told me about how they had been coming. This is middle 70s, starting to move into 76 or something like that. And told me how they were going and doing work periods at Tassajara, this great place, this magical place. I hadn't heard of it. But it sounded good. And so I decided I would start doing it with them. And there was two fellows, Bob Matthews and Stanley Kowalski, or whatever his Polish Jewish name was, I don't remember. But the three of us would go down. We'd go down for the spring before they had fixed the roads, and it was still wet. And that was a journey to get down that road before it had been fixed and was still wet and still raining and still rutted, and you didn't know if you'd make it down there alive. That every spring we did that, with our trucks, and it was like, ooh, we made it, you know. But it became a thing. We did that from like the early, middle 70s. I would do it every spring, and I would stay there all spring. Building things, fixing things. At some point, Bob and I built all the cabins down near, the student cabins down near the barn. That was one summer. But then I became the guy who would oversee doing the decks that at that time, you know, before they changed over to having the hot springs and the pools and whatnot on the other side of the river because the engineers said it was too dangerous at the cliff side, but that side was over on the cliff side. And the steam room was just a natural cave where hot water and hot air was coming in, and the pools were over there, and the decks we would build out into the water, and there were special pieces for that deck and bolts and whatnot and so forth. And I became the guy who came, knew where they all were, oversaw the building of the men's and the women's decks in the water, and I had a crew to do it with. And maybe for 6-7 years, I did that. And then I came in the fall and undid it and put it all away. But it turned out only I knew where everything was. So I had to be there to do that. And both in the spring and the fall. And it turned, so sometimes, I would get a call from, the director, usually it was Maya. If I hadn't shown up in time, and she would say, Richard, are you coming? We need the decks. Nobody else knows where everything is. We need you here. I'd say, yes, sister, I'm coming. I'm coming. You know, I'll be there in a day or two. So I would go, you know, but it was, I kind of enjoyed being the guy that without which there would be no decks. You know, I was the deck guy. But what I did was I fell in love with Tassajara. It's not so much, and I became close to the people. But I wasn't becoming a Zen student. But something was seeping in. I liked these people. I respected these people. I met a lot of people over those years from the 70s all the way now. It's becoming 1989, and I'm there, and I decided, and had decided that Tassajara was my home. It's where I would end up. It's where I could always go. It was where I would always be safe. And to basically finish this, in 1989, for whatever reason, I maybe Mom had cancer, things were bad. I went down to do my spring work and decided, you know, I'm just going to get things in order back home and just stay here. And so in 1989, I just stayed there. I just did my spring, and I stayed for the summer, and I stayed for the fall. And Rev was the head teacher. He was Abbott at that point, I think. And I had to go do like two sesshins before they let me do it, because I hadn't done really any real Zen practice. And so a friend of mine and I went down to San Diego, and we did one with Joko Beck. And Joko Beck was just, you know, that was just, whoa, man, she's this amazing, just powerhouse of a woman, you know, and just both of us, me and Chris, we went down. It was like, wow, that changed us. Boy, she's talking about some stuff. This is going to be good. And then I did another one at Green Gulch, and then we did a couple. And it was okay, and I could go do my Tongario and become a member for the practice period. So 89 was that year where I really started kind of out of loose ends, really, you know, coming and goings of different things, had really started to practice. And when I got out of there, I thought, oh, I'm in now. I'm all set. I'll never stop meditating. And what had happened was, I have to stop, but I need to just mention Catherine, because what happened was the first year I went there, whatever it was, 76 or something, and I was working, fixing the front gate. No other priest or anyone had really talked to me or anything. I mean, we were just given jobs. I had never been there before. And I was just up there alone working, and a woman, priest, came up to me and asked me how I was doing. How are you doing? You need anything? What's your name? Mine's Catherine. I said, mine's Richard. And what happened over those years, she was always there, and I was always there. And I'm the kind of person, I always was the kind of person, if you make a gesture like that to me, I don't forget it. Now you're in with me. And so she became somebody that, for me, was a special, friend. And that friendship, it's worth, that friendship grew not as teacher-student, but as people similar age, interested in each other, talked about everything, talked about relationships, talked about our own relationships, talked about life, and just became really, in my mind, and maybe not in hers, you know, in my mind, we really became nice friends. The kind of when she left in 89, at the end of the 89 period where she was coming up here, she left me. You know, we had no heat there; it was cold, and the winter period practice was cold. And she left me her purple velvet-covered hot water bottle. Now, to me, you can think what you want, but to me, that tells you she liked me too. I didn't just like her. She could have given that to anybody, but she left it to me, you know, so pretty honored by that. And the sad thing is that when I came back here, I started coming, and my thought was, you'll never smoke again. You'll always meditate. You're in. You've done it. This is an ingrained practice now. You've done it for a year. But I was wrong. And I've learned that so many times in my life. You know, you think you've beaten it. You think you've won. You think you're finished with that project. And now you've got it covered, you know. And I mean, it's the same thing with my music playing. Never ever feel that way, that I'm done with it. But with that one, I would come, and I maybe came for a month or two or whatever, and then I fell away. Life, work, relationships, different things, who knows, illnesses. And I didn't come for years. And one day I heard Catherine had died. And I thought to myself, wow, my friend Catherine died, and the only way I found out was some secondhand reading it somewhere. How lost? What happened to you, Richard? And it wasn't even that, wow, boy, to fall away from practice like that, from something that was so valuable and interesting and meaningful to you, it was more, how did you lose touch with your friend, with that wonderful woman? Like, she could die, and you didn't even know it, and you weren't there, and you couldn't be there. And I came here, came back. I remember Jean, just the first day I came back, and for another time and another story, he recognized me. He knew me from a long time ago. And he said, you're home. I said, yeah, I heard Catherine died. I'm back. And I came back really in my mind to honor and to somehow pay homage to Catherine. We went and spread her ashes at Tassajara, but I came back, you know, it wasn't even really to, oh, get back to your practice. It was something I owed Catherine. I don't even know what it was. I needed to come here and honor her and remember her. That turned into, I don't remember when that was, to be honest. I don't know that. I don't remember what year that was. That's my mind, you know. But from that day on, really this more and more, as Jean said, it was my home. This became my main community. I had others, choir, my music friends, whatnot, but this was, for whatever reason, it could have been Sufism, it could have been shamanism, it could have been many things that I had done, but this was here, and I was coming, and this became my practice. And it grew to a point where I just knew, these are my friends, these are my people, this is my support, this is my sangha, this is my practice. I'm not a good Zen practitioner. Maybe you could say I'm a dabbler. But I try to live the practice as well as I can in my life, in the Zendo, and also in those years, for whatever it is, when I first started coming back here, I've gotten older, that changes you, but I've also changed because of my practice here. I've become a better man because of my practice here. I've settled down. Patrick likes to talk about opening the fist up. I've opened my fist. I've settled. I'm gentler. The fight is less. We're living in the middle of a revolution. We're living in the middle of the Anthropocene sixth extinction. You know, my God, that's for another world. But what a time to be alive! But still, in this moment, first to find peace before I can do anything about any of that. And at this age, I don't know what I can, but whatever it is, I'll try. But I know and I feel that this settling, this opening of my hands, this feeling of support that showed itself so beautifully and magnificently when so many people from the Zendo came to help when my sister was dying, and to help her pass in a really graceful and beautiful way. And I've thanked everyone for that. Doesn't hurt to thank again, because that was just amazing to me. What an experience to go through. So here I am. Here we are. There's nothing new. I have nothing to inspire you with except to sit around this fire, to be in this field, to hear the river, to be together in this way, do it as often as possible, and now, as Shuso, to do it more. Do it in a different way. And to do it in a way where really, Koke says, well, all you have to, there's no job, you just love everybody. Well, I do already. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, except Patrick would, you know, he's a problem. He's just a difficult person, you know. But do you work with him as you have?
Now it's time to congratulate you for being that student.
Ah, thank you. So with my admonition, permission to to end my talk with a song. Do I have that permission?
Yes.
Is that okay? If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word or a song, if I can help somebody done been treated wrong, then my living shall not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a good man ought, if I can bring back beauty to a world that's wrought, if I can spread love's message like the Master's taught, then my living shall not be in vain. All Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times. All honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Mahaprajna paramita. All beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.